introduce her, so I would, you know, get to know a little bit about her and have something to say, you know, and because I did not pick her up from the airport. So I met her tonight, and I had heard that she was highly recommended from people on the West Coast all the way to the East Coast. And the first thing she said to me is, "I am not a circuit speaker, and just another drunk." And I said, "Oh, okay." So then, you know, we started a conversation. I asked her if she was married, and I said, "Well, how'd you meet your husband?" She said, "I can't tell you that." Okay. So then, you know, we continued to have a conversation, and I said, "I'm looking forward to your, you know, talk tonight." And she said, "It's not a funny talk." And I went, "Okay." And that's the information I got tonight. So with that, let's give a warm welcome to Brenda from Minnesota.
That's not how it went.
Really?
That's not, my perception of that conversation is totally different than that. Oh. Hi, everybody. My name is Brenda Lindgren, and I'm an alcoholic. And it is really good to be here tonight. Thank you. I'd like to thank Dick and Marjorie and the whole committee for the opportunity to be here and to share this conference with you this weekend. It's a privilege and an honor to be anywhere in Alcoholics Anonymous, and thank you for the opportunity to be here. Because of the grace of a loving God in my life, who is my higher power, and because of the 12 steps of recovery in Alcoholics Anonymous, and because of wonderful sponsorship, and because of people like you and meetings like this, I have not found it necessary to take a drink of alcohol, and I have been sober since July 11th of 1980. And I'm really very grateful for that today, and I'm really pleased about that today. Now, there was a time when I was not pleased about the fact that I was sitting in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. I was watching you tonight as you, as John was asking people who were here for their first roundup tonight, and there were quite a few of you that stood up. And I attended my first AA roundup in Omaha, Nebraska, when I was about a month sober. And I will never forget that roundup. Something special happened there that weekend that I wish I could describe it to you, but you know what it's like. You all know because you're here, so you know what that's about. But it was, I couldn't believe that there were this many alcoholics in the world. You know, I was just like, oh my gosh. I mean, these are all drunks? And it was just, it was a weekend I will never forget. And I have only missed one of those roundups. And I don't live in Nebraska now. But I've only missed one of those roundups since I've been sober. Because it will always be a special part of my sobriety and who I am and where I came from. So I want to welcome you if you're here for the first time. And for those of you who have been here for all of them, like John over here, thank you. Thank you for keeping this alive. I always have these little brain gaps here. My home group is the Chapter 7 group of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I tell you that because I believe it's very important that I know my home group, and I know that I have a home group. And we meet every Thursday night at 7:30 in Minneapolis, Minnesota. And if you're ever in Minneapolis, come when it's summertime. Actually, the weather today here is about the same as the weather in Minneapolis when I left this morning. So, but we meet at 7:30 on Thursday night, and all you need to do is call the central office and tell them that you're in town, you need a meeting, and if you're there on Thursday, you want to go to Chapter 7, and if you don't have a ride, someone will pick you up, and I know that that works, and that's why I tell you that, because I just had an experience, and this is what is so wonderful about Alcoholics Anonymous. you find out that it really does work. It's like, it's a small world. A couple of weeks ago, I was in California, and I said the very same thing, and last week, I showed up at my home group, and there was a woman there from Palm Springs, and she said, I did what you told me. I came to Minneapolis, I called the central office, the intergroup office, I said, I want to go to a meeting on Thursday night called Chapter 7, and I need a ride, and here I am. So it does work. So you're welcome. Come to Chapter 7. One of the things that I was thinking about as I was anticipating coming this weekend was, and I apologize for not being able to get here sooner and hear Dennis share his story last night. I had some AA commitments that I needed to be in town for, but one of the things that's so delightful about this weekend is that one of the gentlemen, in fact, Bob, who's going to be sharing his story tomorrow night, is one of my AA heroes. He's been sober a lot longer than I have. And when I was about, I know I'm going to cry through this whole thing. I have told you, my story is not funny. It's like, Dan, there's a gentleman here by the name of Dan who is on the host committee. And I was standing outside in front, outside here before the meeting, having a cup of coffee, and I was just kind of standing there reflective, and I was into myself. You know how when you get into yourself, you can't see anything beyond this much. And I was into myself, and I was standing there, I was doing this cup of coffee, and Dan came up to me and held out his hand. He said, welcome. He said, we're glad you're here, and he talked about, you know, that he just loves this roundup, and he's been sober about 4 years, and he came here about 4 years ago, and he and his wife were feeling like they, you know, they didn't know anybody, and they were nervous about being here, and some guy came up to him and held out his hand and said, welcome, we're glad you're here, and he said it made all the difference in the world. And I'm standing there, I got tears in my eyes, you know, I'm like, what a wonderful story, because... you know, I want to thank you, Dan, because at that moment, exactly at that moment, I needed for you to come up and shake my hand and say welcome. And that's what it's all about in Alcoholics Anonymous. So I want to say thank you, wherever you are. And I want to say thank you to Bob for, when I moved to the Twin Cities when I was about 5 years sober, I heard Bob used to come out to Three Legacies every December right around his birthday and share his story. And I had been sober probably maybe 7 or 8 years when I heard him speak, and he was talking about that, you know, life still happens even after you're sober. And I was sitting in the meeting not feeling like I was feeling like I was missing something. You know, that when is that light bulb going to go on for me? You know, everybody else, I've always compared my outsides with your insides, or my insides with your outsides. And they never match, you know. And so I'm still going to AA meetings, looking around, saying everybody else has got their stuff together, and I don't. And I've been sober too long to not have it, and this is happening, and that's happening. And, you know, I'm sober, so stuff shouldn't happen. And I heard Bob share his story, and it changed a lot for me, because it was like, wow, he's been sober that long and stuff still happens. You know, maybe it's going to be okay. And it gave me some hope. It gave me some hope that I could continue to move forward in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. And that's exactly what I got the first night I walked through the doors of my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, was hope. And I continue to get that hope every time I come. So, thank you. I've been sober since my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, and there isn't anything really special about that. Like, you know, there's a lot of people who have been sober since their first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. But there's a gentleman, you know, everything I say here tonight is not mine. And it's certainly not reflective of Alcoholics Anonymous, or I do not speak for AA as a whole. I have learned so much from those who have come before me. Everything I talk about is what I've learned from other people, from all of you. There's a gentleman by the name of Tom I from South Carolina. Is he South Carolina? North Carolina. See, I can't even get the state right. But he came and spoke at this Friday night meeting that I attend, and he said, this was like maybe 10 years ago, and he said, you know, he had been sober since his first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. And the reason he shares that is because he was sitting in a meeting one night, and he wasn't quite sure whether he really belonged there. And I've been there, you know. Am I an alcoholic? I can't be an alcoholic. It's not my da-da. You know, there must be something else. You know, the committee. Why am I here? Why am I just have problems in my life. And he said, and I heard the guy say that you don't have to go back out there, that you can stay sober from your first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. So if there's someone new here tonight, I say that because I know that you can stay sober from your first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous until now because I'm here. And it's possible. And please don't leave before the miracle happens. And the miracle that I'm talking about is exactly what it tells me in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. That I will find something that will be sufficient for me to recover from the hopeless state of mind and body. That I have found a sufficient substitute. It says in a vision for you. It asks, have you a sufficient substitute? And the answer is yes, we do. If I had not found that sufficient substitute other than alcohol here in Alcoholics Anonymous, I wouldn't be here tonight. You'd have somebody else, which would be okay, but I have found, and I, through the years, I came to Alcoholics Anonymous not believing I was an alcoholic for a long time and couldn't say I was an alcoholic. But I have found a life that has been beyond what I had ever hoped for. And I have found that sufficient substitute where I can go through life reasonably comfortable in my own skin today. And so I know that there is a sufficient substitute. Please don't leave before that miracle happens. My story is, I guess I need to qualify that why I'm here. You know, I did drink some. There's a part in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous that I always use when I tell my story, and the reason I do that is because it really changed my perception of what the illness of alcoholism was. I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, like many of you, believing that it was like a moral thing and that alcohol really wasn't my problem, it was my solution, because I'm a runner, you know, and when the heat is on and I can't handle life on life's terms, I drank, and alcohol became my solution. And it wasn't until, I don't know if I read this in the doctor's opinion or if my sponsor directed me to read it, but it changed everything for me, because what Dr. Silkworth talks about in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous in the doctor's opinion is me. And I could no longer deny that. And what he says is, men and women drink essentially because they like the effect produced by alcohol. That's why I drank. There is no other reason why, you know, I could stand here and tell you that my father was an alcoholic. I don't know that. You know, my father died at the age of 34 years old of a condition called pancreatitis. I have since learned that is induced by drinking. But I don't know if he was an alcoholic, and it doesn't make any difference. You know, my grandfather drank a lot. I saw him drink daily. I saw him drink in the mornings in my parents' home. I don't know I do believe that there's some genes involved in this. But the reason I drank alcohol is because I liked what it did for me and to me and how it changed my perception of reality. Now, anything that can do that for me on a regular basis, I'm going to keep doing. And so when I read this, it was like, that's it. That's why I drank. He goes on to say that the sensation is so elusive that while they admit that it is injurious, they cannot after a time differentiate the true from the false. To them, their alcoholic life seems the only normal one. They are restless, irritable, and discontented unless they can again experience the sense of ease and comfort which comes at once by taking a few drinks, drinks which they see others taking with impunity. I am not restless, irritable, and discontent when I'm drinking. I know this for a fact because I don't care. You know, I have what Dr. Silkworth describes, is I have an obsession of the mind and a craving of the body. That's the illness of alcoholism. And he talks about the manifestation of an allergy. When I pick up a drink of alcohol and put it in my body, I want more. You know, that drink takes a drink, and then that drink takes a drink, and then who cares? You know, I mean, I am not restless, irritable, and discontent when I have alcohol in my body. And I can't, for me, I know that, you know, when I first was new in Alcoholics Anonymous, people would say, don't pick up that first drink. Call me before you pick up that first drink. And I didn't understand that. It's like, well, what do you mean, don't pick up the first drink? You know, it's not the first drink that gets me drunk. But it is. And today I know that. It is the first drink that gets me drunk because I have an allergy. And I develop that craving, and my body says, I want more. And then who knows what happens. I used to have a lot of blackouts. I used to do a lot of things in blackouts that I don't remember, and it's probably good that I don't remember some of that stuff. And so the other part of my disease is the obsession of the mind. So if I don't start that allergy and take that first drink, then what am I left with? I'm left with the obsession of the mind. And that's where my restlessness, my irritability, and my discontentment comes. He goes on to say that after they have succumbed to the desire again, as so many do, and the phenomenon of craving develops, they pass through the well-known stages of esprit, emerging remorseful with the firm resolution not to drink again. This is repeated over and over. And unless this person can experience an entire, it says that in here, entire psychic change, there's very little hope of his recovery. I don't know about you, but if I don't, sometimes I make up definitions to words. Just because I'm afraid to ask what it really means. Anybody ever had that experience? Or afraid to ask a question, you know, that I might get an answer to? I might find out what's going on because of my fear. You know, my fear of people finding out about me. That fear of losing something I might have or not getting something that I want. Fear dominated my life. And so I always had some kind of a definition in my mind of what psychic meant. But, you know, after I'd been around for a little while, I figured I could probably look it up in the dictionary. It means mind. It says, and unless the person can experience an entire mind change, there is very little hope of his recovery. Now, that's unbelievable. But he goes on to say, on the other hand, and strange as this may seem to those who do not understand, once a psychic change has occurred, the very same person who seemed doomed, who had so many problems he despaired of ever solving them, suddenly finds himself easily able to control his desire for alcohol, the only effort necessary being that required to follow a few simple rules. Oh. Well, that doesn't sound so bad. You know, I always like to tell this because I see it every time I read this in my big book. And I always had a problem with authority when I was growing up. Well, sometimes I still do today, but not as bad as it used to be. And I did not like that word rules in the big book. We were talking about the big book earlier today at dinner. So I crossed it out. And I wrote suggestions because I thought that sounded better than the rules. Now, I'm not trying to change the big book. I know it's still there. I can still see it says rules. And now that word suggestion has changed to actions, because that's what it's all about for me today in Alcoholics Anonymous, is action. You know, I can sit in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous forever knowing that I'm an alcoholic. And believing and accepting that I'm an alcoholic. The knowledge of that is wonderful. Unfortunately, it won't keep me sober. And I know that today. I know that it's in the action. It's in the action that I take. I cannot sit in a meeting and be struck sober. You know, I have to take some action. That's just like my sponsor was talking about. I quit smoking about a year ago, and I've gained about pounds. And so we were talking about that, and she said, you know, it's very difficult when you sit and continue to eat that you're going to wake up the next morning and be struck skinny. You know, and that's true. And I thought, you know, that I could sit in meetings with Alcoholics Anonymous and just be struck sober and wonderful and live life happily ever after. And it doesn't happen that way. I have to take some actions. So, I don't even know when I started. I grew up in the Midwest. I'm a Midwestern. I'm actually an Iowa farm girl. And I grew up in a small little town of about 500 people in Iowa. And my father actually wasn't a farmer. My grandfather was. And I talk about this today. There was a time in my story when I couldn't talk about that. Because there were just, you know, I can remember growing up, I didn't want to be there. You know, I always wanted to be somewhere else. Like tonight, when I was sitting in this meeting, I didn't want to be here. Now, when I'm done, I'm going to be really glad that I'm here. But I've always wanted to be somewhere else that I wasn't. You know, there's something newer, something more exciting, something better, something on the edge over there. And I'm not there, and I need to get there. You know, I was never content with where I was at. And I used to stay with my grandparents a lot, and I used to help my grandfather milk cows. And actually, I'd hide in the milk room while he would get the cows in, because I was always so scared. But I call that helping Grandpa milk cows. But I would help him do that, and we would walk beans and bale hay into tassel corn, and I helped my grandmother gather eggs, and you know, it was a wonderful way to grow up. And my parents, we lived on a farm, but my parents owned a bar in this small little town of about 500 people where there were three bars. And I tell this story because I don't, you know, there is absolutely, I look at it today and I think, is there anything that's really normal about me? And I'm not sure there is. And it doesn't really make any difference because I'm exactly where I'm supposed to be, you know. And I think back on this, and as I tell the story, every time I tell it, I mean, I can see it in my mind. It's as clear as if it was yesterday. The visual picture in my mind is just unbelievable. But my parents owned this bar, and on Sunday mornings, this was before you could serve alcohol on Sundays. And so on Sunday mornings, my brother and I were allowed to go into that bar to help do stuff in the bar, clean the bar up and restock the coolers and so forth. And I couldn't wait to go into that bar on Sundays. I mean, I know exactly what that bar looks like. I remember the red stools along this side and the big wood bar and the coolers behind that. And I remember the booths over on the other side, and there was a jukebox over in the corner. And my dad would go over and flip a switch, and I could play all the music that I wanted, and I'd just stand there and dance and pretend like I was somewhere else. And it was so magical. You know, we're going to have a magician later. And it was just, when you were talking about that, I was thinking, you know, life was so magical. It was like I could just flip a switch and be wherever I wanted to be. And I was just, it was. I can remember the smell even. You know, it smelled like stale booze and stale smoke, you know, and I loved it. I loved that smell. It was like, I'm there, you know, and I haven't even picked up a drink yet. You know, I'm like maybe 9 or 10 years old. And it was just wonderful. And, you know, I took my first drink I had sips. I never saw anything bad happen as a result of drinking in my family. There was always drinking whenever we would get together. There was always a lot of drinking. Like, my brother and I were never allowed to go into that bar during business hours, so I never really, you know, everybody knew what a drunk was. you know, it was one of the men that would stumble out of the bar in the alley and would fall down and not find their way home, and you know, that was the drunk. And yeah, I was never allowed to see anything actually in my family bad happen as a result of drinking. But when I was almost 14 years old, my father died, like I said, suddenly. And I was the oldest of three children, and I don't know, I felt some sense of responsibility. And I remember that summer of my 14th birthday, I got drunk. And I don't exactly remember the circumstances. I'm sure it was probably, we had what we called keggers. I don't know if you're familiar with those. We'd buy kegs, big kegs of beer, and we'd charge, you know, a buck or two for everybody to get in. You could have all the beer you wanted to drink. And I can just remember that I got drunk. And it was absolutely wonderful. I drank because I liked the effect produced by alcohol. I felt for the first time in my life that I was equal to you. That I was equal to you. I never felt equal to you. I either felt less than or more than. I never felt equal to anyone. I felt like I could be whoever I wanted to be. All my inhibitions went away. I could just do whatever I wanted to do. And that's really, you know, that was like all, as magical as standing in that bar and being wherever I wanted to be, whoever I wanted to be. You know, it was just like, and I sought that feeling until I came into the program of Alcoholics Anonymous at 22 years of age. I drank whenever I could. Obviously, when you're living in a small town, you don't have a chance to do that. But I went on to college. I went on to college for radio broadcasting, and that was absolutely crazy. And you know, I look back on it, and I know when things started to change for me, and it was when I left home, because then I was free to drink as much as I wanted, whenever I wanted. And my disease progressed very rapidly. Now, I started drinking as much as I could at the age of 17 in college. My first year of college, I was on the dean's list and doing very well. I had secured my FCC license. I thought I was going to be a radio broadcasting star. You know how we have these grandiose images of, and I hadn't even finished college yet. And my second year of college, I was flunking out because I just couldn't do it. And what had happened was alcohol became more important. And I specifically remember the day when I made the decision that I was just not going to do it anymore. I was not going to go to school. I was not going to be responsible. I was tired. And I'm 18 years old, and I'm tired. You know? What had happened, and I didn't know it then, you know, all of this is, in retrospect, all of this, hindsight is 20/20, is that I had really lost any sense of purpose in my life. And I really had no, all of my aspirations, my goals of what I wanted to do, being some any kind of responsibility with my family, with my mother, with my siblings. I mean, I had a younger sister who was 12 years younger than I was. I practically was a surrogate mother to her after my father died. And all of that didn't mean anything to me. You know, I lost my sense of purpose in life. And what was even more sad about all that is I didn't care. I just didn't care. Drinking was more important. And, you know, when I came to this program, I tried, we were talking about, Chris and I are talking, I tried to convince you that I was not an alcoholic. I didn't drink every day. You know, how could I be an alcoholic? I didn't drink every day. And one of the things that was pointed out to me was, you know, how often did I think about drinking? Yeah, and I look at that and I think, yeah, when I wasn't drinking, I was thinking about drinking. It was like, it was work. You know, I was thinking about, where am I going to go? How much money do I have? Can I afford to drink what I really want to drink? The hard stuff, or do I have to drink beer tonight, or how many can I buy before I have to get somebody else to buy them for me, and what bar am I going to go to, and do I need to stop at the liquor store before I go to the bar so I make sure that I have plenty after the bar closes, or, you know, and then I had three jobs. I was working as a office manager at a siding and insulation company during the day. I was working at a local radio station at night, or on the weekends. I was the weekend shift, and then I bartended at night. And I never had any money. And I was, and I lived above the bar, and I was the one who always had the party. You know, it was just like chaos. It was just, and I came here looking at the first step thinking, my life is not manageable. You know, it's just, that denial is just, it's pretty amazing. Anyway, I moved around a lot, and you know, you all know the story. This time it's going to be different. I continued, you know, and then I look at the second step and say, restore me to sanity, and I didn't, what? If I'm going to be restored to sanity, I must be insane. I'm not insane. You know, but the definition of insanity is continuing to do the same things, expecting different results, and I did that over and over and over. I still do that in sobriety, thinking, oh, this time will be different because I'm sober, or I'm trying it a different way, or something. You know, but you don't understand, I'm different. I'm sensitive. You know, stuff like that. You all know what that is. But I moved around a lot because I'm good at starting over. I'm great. Bob talks about this. I'm great at getting out of the running blocks. You know, and I'm probably great about halfway through, and then I just kind of start to go. I mean, I'm lucky if I can finish the race. But every time I moved, every time I started a new job, every time, this time it was going to be different. You know, John was talking about relationships earlier. You know, I was sitting there laughing. It was like, I never had any relationships. I took hostages. You know, it was like, if you didn't do what I wanted you to do, or do for me what I wanted you to do, or behave in a way that I wanted you to behave, I mean, talk about control. You are of no use to me. You know, I never looked at what I could give to any relationship. I always looked at what I could get. And what is so unbelievable today is that I have had the same relationship with the same man for almost 17 years. And that's because you have taught me how to give, instead of how to get. And that's part of what has changed my life. I forgot where I was at. Let's see, I'm still drunk, right? What happened is I ended up getting a job at a radio station, or at a television station. I moved around a lot. I got a job at a television station in a fairly large area in western Iowa. So I thought, okay, now I'm going to the big city. You know, and I'm going to make my fame and fortune, and it was a great job, and I worked there for about 3 months, 3 or 4 months, and my boss called me in one day, and he said, you know, Brenda, we're going to have to ask you to resign. And I was like, he said, you know, you're great when you show up and do the work. You're great, but you seem to work at your own schedule. You know, you just show up whenever it's convenient for you. And he said, and also I've been noticing that you have a problem. And he said, we're going to let you resign based on the fact that you go talk to someone at the local treatment center about your drinking. And this was the first time that I'd really been confronted by, I'd been confronted by family members, but this was the first time I was confronted by an employer. I said, okay, fine, you know, that's great, I can resign, it'll look good on my resume, and I'd be happy to go talk to the woman at the treatment center. And he said, well, there's the phone, I've got her number, why don't you call her right now? And conveniently, she had some time. And I went over and I talked to her, and she asked me a bunch of questions, and she suggested I stay there for inpatient, and I said I couldn't, and outpatient, and I said, I'll think about it, and she let me go. And I never did go back. I did not go through a treatment facility. But what happened was, when I left there, was probably for the first time, if I'm really honest about it, for the first time I really knew that there was something wrong. And I wanted it to be everything but my drinking. I wanted it to be everything else outside of me. I've always looked for things outside of me to fix me. Always. You know, and you have taught me here that it's an inside job. But I've always looked for people, things, material things, relationships, a job, whatever. I've always looked for something outside of me to fix me on the inside. And I knew that this time it was different. And I was living with an aunt and uncle at the time. I'd gone through a number of family members. They were very kind. They loved me. I was living with an aunt and uncle, and I went back to their home, and I looked in the paper, and I found it. It was like this job just leapt off the page at me. And it was a gentleman who was gaining custody of his two children. He was divorced, and he was getting custody of his two children, and he needed someone to move into his home to take care of these children. And it was like a light bulb went off when I went, that's it. You know, I have gotten away from the family structure. You know, I need to get back into this. I need to get grounded again. I would do a wonderful job taking care of those children. You know, I practically raised my brother and my younger sister. So I went over, I applied for this job. Now, mind you, I am 22 years old. I have short, bleach white hair. For my interview, I wore a tight black leotard with a wraparound skirt and heels about this tall. And I walked in there, and I'm applying for the job of taking care of this gentleman's children. And he hired me. It was great. That amazes me. You know what his thought was? I have to say, No. Maybe he had that thought, but I guess he did, because you need to know that that man is my husband today. I think his ears are burning right now. What a journey, huh? I did not know this, but Terry was sober 5 years in Alcoholics Anonymous the day that I rang his doorbell to apply to take care of his children. And what he saw in me, after he checked my references, he called my family members, and of course I didn't give him the bad references. I gave him like people who I thought would give him good references. Is that my family was saying this, I found this out later, that Brenda will do a wonderful job with your children, but every once in a while she gets a little strange. Well, that's when I would, you know, go on a binge or just not, you know, I'd just go crazy. And who knows when that was going to come up. And he said that his first thought was, you know, if she's an alcoholic, I know where she can get help. And I'm going to take a chance. And he hired me. Of course, in the back of his mind, he did think that possibly I might be with some kind of a theft ring, and so he had inherited some jewelry from his grandparents, and he took all that stuff and locked it in the safety deposit box. And I said, the wonderful thing about that is I've got it all now anyway. So. But what a wonderful thing. What a wonderful thing that he would sit there, and that's what our life is about. That's the way we have lived. I told you that I celebrated 17 years of sobriety last Friday. In November, we will be married 17 years. I did not wait a year to have a relationship. And the thing that I tell the women I sponsor is do as I say, not as I did. But the thing about it is that I am convinced without a doubt, and I stand here tonight without a doubt in my mind, that the reason that we have had that relationship for as long as we have, and that it has worked because I was new in sobriety, is because we both have a recovery program in Alcoholics Anonymous, and we live the principles of the 12 steps in our life on a daily basis as best we can. And we carry the message to others. We have an AA home. And that is the way our entire marriage has been. You know, and he had been sober 5 years, and thank God. And his sponsor said, with my blessing, get married, but stay out of her stuff. And believe me, I tried. I tried to get, I would ask him questions like, well, do you think I should do this? And he'd say, well, I think maybe you should talk to your sponsor about that. See, because if he would make that decision for me and it didn't work out, then I could blame him. And it's just, you know, I've always had a sponsor. He's always had a sponsor. We've just always been active in Alcoholics Anonymous, and it's been a wonderful journey. I was sober 5 years when I moved to Minneapolis from Iowa. And I just knew I wasn't going to stay sober. You know, I was leaving my support system. I was leaving everyone that... I have to tell you what, I need to back up. I got ahead of myself here. When I had been working for Terry for about 2 months, 2 or 3 months, I got restless, irritable, and discontent again. And I had been doing a pretty good job, in my mind. I'd been doing a pretty good job for him. And I decided one night, I got thirsty. And I decided one night that I was going to go out. But I knew that, I did not know that he was in Alcoholics Anonymous at that time. I did not know that. And I told him, I thought it wouldn't sound good if I told him I was going out drinking. So I made up a story that I was going over to my cousin's. It was her birthday. We were going to have cake and coffee and tea, and I'd be home early. And this was on Tuesday, and I came back on Saturday. That was my last spree, okay? And I want to tell you that because I don't want to forget it. I don't want to forget that last spree because I don't want to I don't want to forget my last drunk. And what happened was, he said, fine, you know, and I went to the bar, and I took a drink, and that drink took a drink, and that drink took a drink, and pretty soon, you know, I think I need a vacation. You know, I've been working so hard for this gentleman, and he doesn't pay me enough anyway, and da-da-da-da-da, I think I need a vacation. And then, oh, I forgot, he gave me some money to buy some household things. I'll use that for the vacation. Since I'm underpaid, I can do that. You know how you just, the mind just goes on and on. And I ended up at a place where I used to spend my summers when I was growing up, and called Lake Okoboji. And it was a crazy 4 days. I don't believe I drew a sober breath those 4 days. I lost my car. I ended up at the police station. I tried to buy a boat. A big boat, a houseboat, a big boat. Just a lot of crazy stuff happened during that time. And I remember waking up on Friday, July 11th of 1980, in a motel room by myself, and I was empty inside. There was nothing there. And I don't remember if I said, please God help me. I don't remember what I said. But I knew that this was the end of the road for me. And I really believe that's when I surrendered. And I've been surrendered many times in this program, but that was my first surrender. And I called my mother, and they were just happy that I was still alive because no one had heard from me. And I went back to her home, and she said, call Terry, and I called Terry, and Terry said, come back. You still have a job, and I know where you can get some help. And what he did was he called another woman who had been sober a number of years in Alcoholics Anonymous. She 12-stepped me, and she took me to my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. And she took me to, we went to meetings for 90 days after that. She was there with me at every meeting. It was amazing. And I said, they told me to go to 90 meetings in 90 days, and I said, oh, I can't do that. My mom, well, I, you know, then I found out that my employer is a member of Alcoholics Anonymous, and he believes in 90 meetings in 90 days. And so we worked it out a schedule, and she either picked me up, I met her at her house, or she met me at the meeting. And what a wonderful example. That's called attraction. You know, she attracted me into the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. I wanted what she had, and I didn't have any idea what she had. But I knew that I wanted someone who would take that time out of their schedule to take a complete stranger to a meeting every night
and be there. It was just, it was unbelievable to me. And, you know, after the meeting, they would always ask me to go to coffee, and I'd say, no, I can't go to coffee. And they'd keep asking, you want to go? No, I can't go to coffee. Finally, one night, I got up enough courage to go to coffee. And I was always really worried about, you know, what my perception of what people thought of me. And we kind of went around the table, and people were talking, and I finally got up enough courage to say something, right? I don't even remember what it was I said. And after I said it, I went, oh, I shouldn't have said that. And then I kind of looked for everybody's response, and then, oh, I really shouldn't have said that. And then, you know, we finished our coffee, and I'm driving home from the meeting, and I'm thinking, why did you say that? That was so, now, see, I'm not self-centered. You know, there's nothing self-centered about. I'm thinking about what I said. Who cares what anybody else said? And I'm thinking about this all the way home, and I'm thinking, my gosh, that was so stupid. How could you say that? You finally went to coffee, and I got home, got ready for bed. I can't get settled. I mean, you know, I just can't go to coffee again. You know, that was so stupid. I won't be able to go to coffee again. And then pretty soon, it's like, I'm not sure I can go back to that meeting. You know how your mind is? I mean, they probably think I am so weird. You know, where did this woman come from? You know, like, and I just, it was like, I don't think I can go back. And then something that I've been told, it's a repetitive thing, I know I heard it because it came to mind, and it was, you can call me anytime, day or night. Doesn't make any difference what's going on. And I thought, you know, maybe this is one of those times that I should probably call. And it was 1-2 o'clock in the morning. And I picked up the phone and I called and I told Pat what was going on. And I said, you know, I'm not sure I can go back to that meeting. And there was this silence on the phone. And then she said to me, Brenda, do you think that everybody is at home right now losing sleep over what you said? You know what that was? That was my first glimpse of some humility. I was not humiliated, but what happened was I had a brief glimpse of what it talks about in step 5 in the 12 and 12. I had somewhat of a recognition of who and what I had become. But on the other hand, I had a sincere desire to be what I could be and to change. And I knew that she was right. And I went to sleep. You know, and that is what has happened continually over and over and over in my sobriety. The God of my understanding speaks to me through you. That's why today it isn't so important for me to continue to go to meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous. Because when I don't go to meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous, I shut myself off from the God of my understanding and the sunlight of the Spirit. And, you know, I recently just was sharing with someone on step 11, and I had such a difficult time with prayer and meditation, especially meditation. And one of the things for me today is when I'm in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, it's meditation. You know, when I was newly sober, I could not sit still. I was all over the place. My legs were going. I was up getting coffee. When I wasn't talking, I was thinking about when my turn was going to come, what I was going to say, and I never heard anything that you said, and I was just all over the place. And today, I can sit in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I can hear what you say. I can really hear what you say, and it touched me. And that's like meditation. That's like God talking to me through you. What a wonderful gift. You know, I did stay sober when we moved to Minneapolis, and I got hooked up with some people like the Bobs and Chuck and just Don and all those guys, and there were some women too, Esther, and I got involved, you know, and I just kept showing up. And pretty soon I was involved in general service, and my sponsor was involved in general service, and she was dragging me to area assemblies and doing all this stuff, and I was involved in the district, and I was carrying the message, and I soon forgot that I was even in a new place, you know, and that's been the journey for me. My sponsor today talks about doing the deal, and the simpler I keep it, the better. You know, it's just all about going to meetings, and I try to go to at least 3 meetings a week. That's the least I can do for my recovery. And I try to carry the message to others, to sponsor other women. I call my sponsor every night, Monday night at 6 o'clock. And you know what is so wonderful? Is that if she's not going to be there, she calls me to tell me she's not going to be there to take my call. And that's, I hope someday I can be like that. I want what she has. You know, and it's just, it's all about getting out of myself and giving. You know, and you've taught me how to do that. My children today, Terry and I are still married, and he will celebrate 22 years of sobriety in August. And the children today have been with us since 1980, and they're now 25 and 24 years old. And the 24-year-old will celebrate, I believe the sobriety date's in November, he's coming up on 3 years of sobriety. And it's just a wonderful way of life. You know, it's, if someone had asked me, and I know you've heard this before, if someone had asked me when I came into the program of Alcoholics Anonymous what I would want if I was granted 3 wishes, I would have sold myself short, because those things have happened a long time ago. You know, it's all about just showing up and doing the deal. It is not by coincidence that anything in my life has happened. You know, I think about that, how I ended up on Terry's doorstep. But my home group is called Chapter 7, which in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous is working with others. And I want to close with something that, you know, I came into this program really disliking women. Women to me were competition. And I really did not have, my friendships and relationships with women were very superficial. And today I sponsor a number of women, and it's unbelievable. It's like holding up a mirror in front of me. I get to see me. And that's been a wonderful gift. In a couple of weeks, I have the opportunity and the privilege to be able to travel out to Wyoming for a conference out there, and a couple of the women I sponsor are going to drive out there with me. You know, that's wonderful. I mean, that's life. That's life on life's terms. I get to show up every day and do the best that I can, and life just happens. You know, I don't have to create chaos anymore. I don't have to live on the edge anymore. I don't have to be somebody I'm not. I don't have to compare my insides with your outsides. I can just show up for life, and life happens. I don't have to create it anymore. What it says, and we read this at my meeting every Thursday night, it says, practical experience shows that nothing will so much ensure immunity from drinking as intensive work with other alcoholics. It works when other activities fail. This is our 12th suggestion. Carry this message to other alcoholics. You can help when no one else can. You can secure their confidence when others fail. Remember, they are very ill. Life will take on new meaning. To watch people recover, to see them help others, to watch loneliness vanish, to see a fellowship grow up about you, to have a host of friends. This is an experience you must not miss. We know you will not want to miss it. Frequent contact with newcomers and with each other is the bright spot of our lives. And I want to thank you for being the bright spot of my life. Thank you.